Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great privilege to welcome back a man who's given a tremendous amount of thought and intelligence to the challenges of national security over a very distinguished multi-decade service to his country, both in uniform, rising to the rank of a lieutenant general in the United States Air Force, and through his role as a commentator for Fox News and Fox News Business Channel, and also in other capacities, including as the past president of Business Executives for National Security, and these days as the founder and president of Government Reform Through Technology, a consulting firm. He is, of course, Lieutenant General Thomas McInerney, United States Air Force. He retired as the Assistant Vice Chief of Staff of the Air Force and Director of its Defense Performance Review. General McInerney, it is so good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me, Frank.
I'd like to begin with sort of an overview, if I could, General, of the sort of strategic environment in which we find ourselves. Give us your reading on where we find ourselves at the dawn of the Trump administration.
Well, we've been at this for 15 years, and it was miraculous that President Trump was elected against all odds, and he is given the worst hand, I think, I have seen in my lifetime, to include World War II, that any president has been given in the national security regime. You look at Russia expanding. You look at North Korea firing four missiles off yesterday. You look at the Middle East. The Middle East has never been in such a disruptive stage, even during the Crusades, Frank. I don't know how President Obama could have made it so unstable in his 8 years, but he managed to do it. And the reason I say that, he also left us with a $20 trillion debt. Now, people can say, well, President Truman had a huge problem at the end of World War II. I would agree with that. But we were the sole economic power, and we had that within our reach, and we had 11 million people in arms when he took over as president, and the only nuclear power. So I believe that President Trump has been given a very difficult deck of cards.
One of the problems that has exacerbated this, and I think your characterization of it is very apt, General McInerney, is a failure to understand who we're up against for the past 15 or 16 years. Donald Trump came to office, and I agree with you, it was nothing short of divine intervention, to my way of thinking. But he came in part on a platform of saying, listen, I'm going to take a different approach. I believe we need to understand that radical Islamic terrorism, as he calls it, I think of it as Sharia supremacism, is the enemy we're confronting, and we need to deal with it as such, not pretend it has nothing to do with Islam or that these are individuals who are trying to hijack the great religion of peace, that there's an actual strategic vision that flows from this doctrine of Sharia. How important do you think it is that that be gotten right? And how do you think the Trump administration's personnel, shall we say, south of the president, are doing in internalizing and acting on that vision?
Well, first of all, the president recognizes the threat and calls it what it is. And we owe a great deal to General Mike Flynn, who inculcated those ideas with them of calling it radical Islamic terrorism. The fact is you are correct. It's a global jihad movement in the precise terms. But for me, I like the term radical Islam because it puts the burden on Islam and the Muslims to fix the problem. Either way, it's the same thing. And it is this Sharia supremacy that is driving this, that is an existential threat to the United States. You and the Center for Security Policy put out this magnificent book called The Secure Freedom Strategy, in which you laid out a plan for victory over the global jihad movement. And you had a tiger team, and I know most of your people. It is the most profound document that I have read in the 15 and a half years that we have been going after this threat that I had to learn on my own. And you and your team, Frank, have done a magnificent job. If President Trump would take this book and if he would implement this strategy, we will win this fight. If he does not, and there are indications that some of his people below him are not understanding it. Now, let me put it this way. We had military that have fought, and they have done extremely well as far as their individual bravery, et cetera. But to ever think that the counterinsurgency strategy would win hearts and minds was fallacious. The fact is, they did not want and do not want in Islamic societies our Jeffersonian democracy. They wanted our money, and we poured $6 trillion into this fight. And unfortunately, many of our very, very senior military people who have been calling under both Bush and Obama, calling this a violent extremism threat, the ideology of which I do not know. I know the ideology of the global jihad movement or radical Islam. That's the Quran, the Hadith, and Sharia law. Those three things are what driving them. It is their rules of engagement. It allows them to behead people, to have sex slaves, to murder innocent, quote, infidels. And so until we re-educate our military, law enforcement, and all our people associated with national security, that's why I would recommend to the president that he read this and every person in government, to include every airman, soldier, marine, sailor, read this book, and we change our strategy. Right now, I'm concerned.
Well, thank you very much for that very generous endorsement. You know, we mostly owe credit to Ronald Reagan for having devised a very similar strategy. In fact, the one that we modeled the Secure Freedom Strategy on, as you know, General McInerney, you were there, was the one that Ronald Reagan used to defeat the last totalitarian ideology, namely Soviet communism. But I couldn't agree more that this kind of vision and course correction is needed. One of the issues that we've been wrestling with is a fight within the administration over some of the personnel who are still running some things, notably Obama holdovers, and some of the people that the president's own picks for secretaries of various cabinet offices have been trying to bring into the government. If you could talk a little bit about the importance of getting that right, General, that we've got a president who has a vision, and if he doesn't have subordinates who are committed to its execution, not only is the vision not going to get fulfilled, but probably, in this case at least, the very security of the United States itself will be imperiled.
Great question, Frank. As I mentioned, the Bush and Obama administrations talked about violent extremism, so they did not know the enemy. They did not know how to defeat this ideology of radical Islam, the global jihad movement. President Reagan laid out a strategy in NISDM 75 in which he laid out how we defeated the Soviet Union and the communist ideology. You have, in your book, laid out a similar strategy. Now, what is disturbing to me is the early indications, granted, we're, 2.5 months into this administration, is some of the new cabinet members and some that are leftover skills from the Bush and the Obama administration are trying to bring in Democrats and anti-Trumpers, people that do not understand what the American people elected President Trump for. And this is very disturbing. Those coupled with the remaining Obama people there that have left trap doors, et cetera, we won't go into that, but they are thinking the same strategy. If they continue on that, if they bring in these people that already had inherited the failed strategy, for instance, like Ann Patterson, who was the ambassador in Cairo when we had Benghazi and the problems over there, who supports the Muslim Brotherhood. She may not say that, but the Obama administration was supporting the Muslim Brotherhood afar as well as in the United States.
Yeah, her record is pretty clear, too, on that score as well. General McInerney, there's so much more to talk about. We are hard out of time, though. I hope that we might impose upon you again soon. I appreciate your counsel as well as your past service to our country tremendously. And thank you for your encouragement to us at the Center for Security Policy. We will be endeavoring to get the Secure Freedom Strategy read as widely as we can. Keep up your good work, my friend, among other places, at Government Reform Through Technology. We'll talk with you soon. Next up, we'll talk with Shakok Abbas about Kurdistan. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Shakok Abbas. He is the president of the Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria, a subject that is very much, I think, on the minds of those of us who are concerned about the future direction of the Middle East at a moment when it is roiled by civil war, efforts to establish a caliphate, and various threats, particularly to the interests and security of the United States, as well as its friends and allies in the region. It's a pleasure to welcome Shakok, I believe, for our first time to Secure Freedom Radio. Sir, very good to have you.
Hello, Frank. Thank you for inviting me. Actually, this is the second time to your program. Yeah.
Forgive me. I suspect you may have talked with my colleague, Jim Hansen, but I think it's our first conversation. In any event, we're delighted to have you with us. Let me ask you to describe a little bit what the Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria is and how you would describe its aspirations.
Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria was formed in 2006. Its goal to bring at least a federal system into Syria, to allow the Kurds to have their control over their affairs. Their rights were denied. It is an umbrella group for Kurdish political parties, tribal civic organization. So in a nutshell, it focuses on the Kurds of Syria and how they should work with the West and how it's compatible with America and the West and be friends and allies with America and the West in that region. So that is our organization in general.
Just very quickly, do you seek an independent Kurdish state or do you envision being part of a federalist system within Syria?
It's not easy to change like a SPICO agreement we do in the borders in the Middle East, but it looks like that's going to happen, at least what it appears in Iraq and Syria. Yes, Kurds have the rights like any other nation, and we're 40 million strong Kurds in that region from Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Turkey. We should have our own rights to have independent Kurdistan. But if not, at least the next best alternative is a federal system in mirroring Iraqi Kurdistan, and the Kurdistan region in Syria.
We're visiting with Shakok Abbas of the Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria, and you were describing a situation that is clearly ripe for a fresh look, and that is the opportunity for the people of Kurdish extraction to join together across borders that have existed since World War One, but that are arbitrary and do not reflect certainly their national aspirations. That would bring you fairly quickly up against, among others, the Turks. Talk a little bit about the relationship between your movement and the Turks at the moment.
Well, I mean, we see the only objective Turkey has is to crush the Kurdish aspiration. And of course, there are a few excuses for Turkey. The PKK element roaming in Kandil Mountain in Iraq and Kurdistan, also controlling certain elements of YPG, PYD in Syria, has given them some uneasiness on what's going on in Syria. And they would like to really roll that back and have it controlled by a group allied with Turkey that are mostly Muslim Brotherhood at best. In fact, many of those elements are radical, very close to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But it's bad for Turks and the Kurds and the whole international community by what they're doing is supporting a Muslim Brotherhood affiliated groups to control Syria by bringing foreigners into the region and trying to, you know, view the Kurds in one breath, you know, as one, the PKK. Not all Kurds are PKK. most of the Kurds are pro-America, pro-West. They're anti-Marxist. So why not work with the Kurds? This is a question, you know, for Turkey to answer. They're more fearful of having that precedent in Iraq and Syria that could lead similar federation in Turkey. And I think they view ISIS as a lesser threat than Kurds right now.
Shirk Abbas, could I ask you to talk a little bit more about this force that is at work, of course, very much in Syria, that is aligned with the Turkish government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and a problem, I believe, for not just our interests and friends in the Middle East, but for us here in the United States as well, namely the Sharia supremacists associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Give us a flavor of what they're doing in the Middle East, but also more broadly, and whether we should be concerned about it.
Well, I would say we have to be very concerned, especially the Wahhabism. A lot of Gulf, GCC, are promoting Muslim Brotherhood equivalent or various variations of ISIS or equivalent to it in that part of the world. And Turkey is also doing the same. So Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia have a lot of interest promoting Sunni radical extremists. But on the other hand, we should not forget that Iran is just as equally as bad, in fact, even worse. Iran is playing. Obama had handed the Middle East on a silver platter to Iran. And this is a time that Kurds could really stop the Shia Crescent or the Sunni threat to the international community. But they need the international support for that. We are against the Sharia, Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, we want this administration to really view the Kurds as an allies, work with the Kurds in that part of the world to crush ISIS and to crush this radical Islamic terrorist in that region.
Yeah, I appreciate you emphasizing the role of the Iranians as well in all of this. It's clear that they are aspiring to a broader place in the Middle East and hegemony, really. And this so-called Shiite Crescent, as you've described it, is one manifestation of that. Just very quickly, Shirk Abbas, of the Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria, do you envision out of all of this dynamic activity, especially if the Obama administration's policies of empowering the Iranians and enabling the Russians to operate with a free hand in Syria, that there will be an opportunity to fashion, in the final analysis, a free and independent Kurdish nation?
What Obama's administration did is, as I mentioned earlier, allowing Iran to control Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. In fact, they're extending the region out to the Red Sea and to the Mediterranean. So this is Iran is in full control, allowing the Russians to be in full control of Syria and the rest of that part of the world and threaten American interest and American allies in that region. What Obama has done is absolutely made the friends and foe do not trust America. Now for this new administration to do something and correct the course and direction of the U.S. by working with the Kurds. And we have seen a positive sign from the new administration, but no concrete steps on working with the Kurds that are allied with America and are anti-Marxist, anti-Iranian, anti-ISIS group. And this is the overwhelming majority of the Kurds are pro such views and the friends of the West and America, and we should really approach the Kurds and work with them.
Yeah. Give me, if you could, just in 30 seconds, Shoko, a specific sort of plan of action that you would recommend for the Trump administration in that regard.
To work with the Kurds directly and find an umbrella group like Kurdnas, KNC, other groups within Syria, by supporting them and finding a way to really crush Iranian interest, but at the same time building a mirroring Iraqi Kurdistan administration in north of Kurdistan of Syria. I think this is something they can do and they can achieve, but they can sponsor such event. This is what we would like from them.
As a practical matter, does that mean mostly, and in the first instance at least, arming the Kurds?
Absolutely, all kinds of support. It started with politically and then army. Yes, and they can be the boots on the ground.
Yeah. Serco Abbas of the Kurdistan National Assembly of Syria, I appreciate very much your time today and hope that we can continue this conversation as the Kurdish angle is a clearly key piece of any ultimate solution to the crises that we're facing in the Middle East at the moment. Thank you for your service, sir. Come back to us again if you would very soon. Next up, we'll talk with one of the great investigative reporters of our time, Richard Pollack. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of the great investigative reporters of our time. He is Richard Pollack, these days the senior investigative reporter for The Daily Caller. He's held a number of similar roles in other publications and outlets, including PJ Media, Good Morning America, and Fox News Sunday. And he's one of the people that we turn to with regularity, I'm very pleased to say. Thank you for that, Richard Pollack, to sort of suss out what's going on behind the headlines on stories like what we're dealing with respect to this, well, deep state effort to undermine President Trump. Richard, I know this is an unfolding story, but I'm very glad to have a chance to pick your brain a little bit about it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're told, Richard, over the weekend in particular by none other than the President of the United States, that he believes that Barack Obama was directly involved in running surveillance operations, essentially using intelligence service assets in the midst of a political campaign against a man Barack Obama clearly sought to defeat. I know that we don't have a lot to go on here, but I'm interested in getting your take on what you think has actually been taking place. What evidence is there that the Obama administration has been engaged in what might be thought of as dirty tricks in the last campaign?
Well, all of this sounds very Nixonian. And in fact, there are indications that this administration, you call it the deep state, they played some very nasty hardball against its opponents. And so we have to go and see how this thing unfolds with respect to the wiretapping of then candidate Trump's campaign headquarters at Trump Tower in New York. But it's intriguing to me to see that the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee has accepted that as part of a legitimate inquiry in terms of their investigation into this whole issue of the fate of Russia and the election. And so that gives me a sense that there may be something there, and we'll have to see how that plays out. Also, I might add that there are people who say, well, the president himself could not directly order a wiretap, and this is true. There are safeguards against that. However, that doesn't mean a leading figure in the administration, such as Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, could not have asked the FISA court, which is a special court on wiretapping, to undertake wiretaps against their perceived enemies, in this case, Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, I think now it's in the public domain. Mark Levin has been doing a super job of connecting a lot of dots on this, that the FISA court was asked back in June, I think, of last year to permit a pretty wide-ranging surveillance against the Trump team, was turned down at that time, we're told, and then was importuned once again, presumably by Loretta Lynch in the Justice Department to allow a more focused but nonetheless quite, I think, controversial surveillance of the Trump campaign in October of last year. So those are data points that do, I think, warrant the kind of scrutiny that apparently, as you say, Representative Nunes is now prepared to engage in the House Intelligence Committee. Let me ask you about one other piece of this. You've done some very interesting reporting, Richard Pollack, about the Department of Homeland Security's, it sounds like cyber war against some state election operations in the course of this campaign. Remind us what you found in that regard and whether it might have some bearing on this whole idea of the possibility of dirty tricks being played by the Obama administration against Donald Trump.
Well, in the summer of last year, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, was trying to get the election systems of all 50 states declared a federal critical infrastructure, which would be immediately federalizing our state. Now, our founding fathers, in their wisdom, said that they wanted to have the local state, not the federal government, have anything to do with electioneering. So there were a large number of state secretaries of state, and people may not know, the secretaries of state actually run the election systems in almost all of our states. And the secretaries of state fought against this, and there were a number that fought against it, and it turns out we now have learned that someone at the Department of Homeland Security decided to target these critical secretaries of state and to actually attempt to hack the election systems in those states. One state is in Georgia, another one apparently was West Virginia. We also know, very troubling, that they attacked the Indiana system, which of course was then Governor Mike Pence's state, and he was of course running as vice presidential running mate with Trump. So we have what appears to be Nixonian tactics in this area, which would make a person potentially believe, gee, could they have had other tricks up their sleeve? Are there other dirty tricks that they've pulled up? It also gives you a sense of the idea of them playing hardball, of punishing people that they perceive are enemies. And of course, that is sort of what has always been associated with the presidency of Richard Nixon. And is Obama the next in of the 21st century? We have, we'll have to see how this plays out, but it's very disturbing what they tried to do against the state in the summer and fall of this year.
Yeah. Richard Pollack of the Daily Caller is our guest. It seems to me, at the very least, what that particular insight suggests is that we do need to know, what did Barack Obama know and when did he know it about the surveillance apparently conducted against Donald Trump and his team in the course of the 2016 election? Richard, let me switch gears. One of the other objects of your reporting of late has been the state of play, the sorry state of affairs, really, of the United States military. And you've captured that brilliantly, it seems to me, in a microcosm, kind of a byproduct, I think of it as, of the President Obama's, that is, effort to engage in rampant social engineering of the military. Talk a little bit about your report on the Navy.
Well, under the Obama administration and under the administration of Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, there was a massive buildup of women on ships. Now, ships are in close quarters. You're there for days, weeks, months, and all sorts of things could happen in that kind of a situation. It turns out that under the Freedom of Information Act of the Daily Caller News Foundation, with whom I work, and the Daily Caller sister organization, we filed a FOIA request with the Navy about how many pregnant women there are in the Navy over the last 2 years. And the numbers we got were astounding. 16 out of every 100 women on ships over the last 2 years were transferred off of ships because they became pregnant. Now, this really affects the state of readiness for all of our ships. Imagine a company in which every 16 people have to leave because they're pregnant, and they have to leave for 2 years, which is the period that they are off when they do give birth. And just imagine what kind of chaos that and hardship that will put on a ship and on a ship's crew and the remaining crew that have to go and pick up the responsibilities of these women who have left. This is an all-time high. And I might add, it's very interesting because a female admiral in the Navy under Obama wanted to increase the number of women to 25% on every ship, every warship, supply ship, surface ship, submarine, etc. Thankfully, we haven't gotten there. But there's a very serious cultural problem going on in the Navy where they're trying to really push a social program that I think really puts in peril our readiness to be able to do all of the things that have to be done in order to be prepared to meet an adversary. It's a very serious problem. Don't know whether the Trump administration is going to address it and General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, a new one, but it is certainly a very worrisome development of what's happened over the last 8 years.
It is indeed, Richard Pollack, and I appreciate so much your bringing it to all of our attention through the work of the Daily Caller News Foundation and your investigative reporting there. It does, as I think, scream out for corrective action. And the trouble is that thanks to the legacy of Barack Obama and Ray Mabus, his Secretary of the Navy, it's going to be some time before they can unwind the effects of this on readiness and on morale, and almost certainly on the families of the men and women in these ships around the world. It's a staggering issue, and we need attention to it right away. Richard, thank you for yours. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang about the North Koreans' latest missile salvo. What it might mean for you. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Gordon Chang is in the house, I'm pleased to say, our duty expert on Asia, also that of The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, Fox News. We catch up with him, in fact, at CNN at the moment. Gordon, thanks so much for finding a few minutes for us. Good to talk with you.
Oh, always great to talk with you, Frank.
Let's talk about North Korea, shall we? There's apparently a new missile salvo fired off of the coast of Japan over the past day or so. I know you're on the case, Gordon. What should we make of what the North Koreans have done, and what do you think others in the region are going to do in response?
Well, I think there are two things that we should take away from North Korea's missile salvo. One of them is they fired four missiles at the same time. If they were really interested in testing, they'd fire one, look at the telemetry, learn, improve, and then fire another one. I think that what they're trying to do is make a political point. They're always very provocative during this time of year, during the joint South Korea-U.S. exercises, Foul Eagle, Key Resolve. But, you know, the other thing is important, and this is with a bit of background. North Korea right now looks unstable. There were so many instances of instability last month. And so Kim Jong-un, the ruler's risk threshold, must be pretty low. And so although we could say, well, maybe this was just sort of meant to make a political point, we've got to be concerned that Kim Jong-un could do something that could really surprise us. And this is something that we sort of roll our eyes at all the time. But nonetheless, North Korea is becoming increasingly dangerous.
Gordon, just very quickly, what are some of the signs of instability that you're referring to there?
Well, at the beginning of last month, we learned that the Minister of State Security was demoted. And then later in the month, we heard that five of his associates were executed by anti-aircraft fire. On February 12th, when the North Koreans launched their intermediate-range ballistic missile, the head of North Korea's Strategic Rocket Forces was not on site. That indicates trouble at the top of the North Korean military. And then, of course, there was the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the elder half-brother of North Korea's ruler. That's extremely serious in a Confucian society. It's more heinous than it would be in ours. So this points to real problems at the top of the regime in Pyongyang. And so we've got to be concerned that although they may do things which we've seen in the past, they are now in a context which looks to be much more volatile.
Gordon, one of the concerns, of course, for people in the region is that volatility and the possibility that it could translate into very imminent threats to them. What do the Japanese, for example, and the South Koreans make of this missile salvo? Have there been any responses from their governments to date?
Yeah, first of all, the Japanese, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe gave the Japanese government response. He was visibly worried. At least three of these missiles landed in Japan's exclusive economic zone, which is that band of water extending between 12 and 200 nautical miles from a country's shore. South Korea also talked about the provocation, but they're not really in a position to do very much. Of course, the United States is, and we haven't done anything really serious for about two decades. So this is sort to be on us. Now, I can understand that the Trump administration is in early days, has not been able to really develop a response and to implement it. But we don't work on our timetable. We work on the timetable of others. And the North Koreans have made it very clear that they intend to challenge us.
Gordon, one of the things that's been reported over the weekend, I believe, by the New York Times was an effort by the Obama administration to conduct cyber operations against some of these North Korean missiles. Is there a possibility that the salvo is a retaliation for that kind of interference in their program, and that it might have been meant to demonstrate that their missiles actually work, despite what we reportedly have done to screw them up?
Yeah, I think that that's very possible interpretation of what the North Koreans were intending to convey. Also, as I mentioned, it was during the military exercises, so North Korea was going to do something. This also occurs at the beginning of what the Chinese call their two sessions. The more important of those two sessions is the meeting of the National People's Congress. So this is an important time of the year in the Chinese political calendar. So there's a lot of birds that Kim Jong-un was able to knock out of the sky with his missiles.
Gordon, you've described in one of your recent pieces the ties between the Chinese and the North Koreans at the moment as being testy. This is a government in Pyongyang that we, I think, believe would not exist but for the sufferance and support of the Chinese government. If there is, in fact, a serious worsening of those ties, is it possible that this will further exacerbate the instability about which you're expressing some concern in the North?
Of course. There's always the possibility that anything would upset the North Koreans, and especially if the Chinese actually, in fact, started to apply real pressure on them. Now, they did announce a ban on the purchase of North Korean coal through the rest of 2017, but that really was just implementing previous UN Security Council sanctions. If they were to do something more, maybe North Korea would react, but we got to remember that the North Korean regime, you know, has its own reason, but it is rational and it is trying to survive. So I don't think that they would lash out, because that would mean the end of the regime. Nonetheless, we've got to start thinking about different ways to approach this, because we have always been very concerned about not destabilizing North Korea. But what we're getting, though, is a country with long-range launchers, three of them that can already reach the lower 48 states, plus nuclear weapons. And within, let's say, 3 years, 4 years, maybe 5 years, they'll be able to mate those two, to put those weapons on top of those missiles and reach about any place in the United States. So we don't have very much time to figure this out, Frank.
Yeah, I'd be surprised if it's that long, in fact, Gordon. Let me ask you, and again, our guest is Gordon Chang, the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, but also The Coming Collapse of China. And Gordon, with respect to the Chinese, you've written at World Affairs Journal recently about how the Chinese seem to be angling to try to, well, fill a vacuum that may be perceived in their part of the world, or maybe more broadly, by America somewhat disengaging under Donald Trump. Do you see that as being something that they can actually pull off, given some of their own internal difficulties? And do you think that the Trump administration is, in fact, creating a vacuum that might be filled in that fashion?
Well, I think the Trump administration is creating somewhat of a vacuum. We saw that most notably with the withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is the 12-nation trade deal. That is a real setback for the United States in Asia, maybe not from a trade point of view, but certainly from a strategic point of view. The Chinese are already trying to take advantage of that. We know that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, talked about globalization, and he wrapped himself in that mantle at Davos in January. And he's also now starting to talk about how China can guide the world to a more democratic international system. So clearly the Chinese are trying to take advantage of it. The good news here is that unfortunately for Xi Jinping, he cannot align his country's policies with his rhetoric. And so therefore, I think that he will ultimately fail in trying to assume global leadership. But nonetheless, we've got to be very concerned about the way that things are going, especially as the Trump administration talks about America first, which is something that grates around the world. And so we've got to understand, yes, we need to protect our economy. We should certainly do so. But we also have to remember that our security is dependent upon goodwill and the cooperation of countries around the world.
Some more than others, that's for sure. Gordon Chang, very quickly, do you expect any surprises out of the so-called two sessions that the Chinese are now going through? Is there any real possibility that this might further upset Xi's apple cart?
I don't think there's going to be any surprises. The whole thing has been designed not to be surprising in what is a sensitive political year for the Communist Party, because at the end of the year, they have their 19th Party Congress. So I don't think there's going to be anything that is going to take us by surprise.
We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Thank you for your time today. As always, it's great to talk with you. We look forward to doing so again next week and to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.